Hi, this is Maureen Milliken.
And this is Rebecca Milliken, and this is Crime and Stuff.
The podcast.
You would do if you had nothing better to do.
And we're also late, a week late. We just, life gets in the way.
Well, I want to say.
We don't need to go into all the details of why.
I do want to thank you, my sister.
Me?
Yes, you. Mo has picked up the slack for me because I have been extremely busy at my real job.
I've kind of picked up the slack. We're still a week late and some of that's my fault. That,
if people are wondering, it's because I've just been
extremely
busy. Yeah,
I mean, we do have, unfortunately, as much as we'd like to do this for a living.
Yes, we don't. And so that's why, if people are wondering why I haven't done one for a while.
They're probably like, oh my God, I cannot listen to Mo's voice.
Hopefully, I'll be doing the next one.
But you do have an update.
I do have an update, and it's on one we just did. Was that the last one I did? Shay McKenna?
Possibly. Yes, it was, because then we went into our whole series of Maine police shootings.
Yes, he was shot by police this past fall. He shot his brother December 2022. Then he was shot by police in October of 2023. As we discussed, and if you want to listen to our last few episodes, if you haven't, the Attorney General's office, every time there's a police-involved shooting, does an investigation. Just like always, they were found justified. They said they were in evident danger by Shay. In September, when he was shot, 2023, Shay's mother, Lori McKenna, said, "They'll probably say it's justified. It always seems justified." Mm-hmm. And she was right. She also said back then, they gunned him down. They gunned him down. They murdered my son. She's talking about police. We discussed a lot of it in that episode, so I'm not going to go into details, but he was in a trailer. He came out in his, he had a bulletproof vest on. He had guns. This is in their report. Trooper Parks observed Mr. McKenna scanning the wood line, appearing to hunt for people. And they shot him and he died, and he knew he was going to be shot by them, I think. So this finding just came out like 2 days ago. It was no surprise. We weren't surprised.
No, we weren't. First of all, one thing that bugs me is the articles never say what the standard is.
Yes,
that the Attorney General finds things justified and unjustified. And as we've talked about in our last couple of episodes, it's whether they're criminally responsible, and it's a legal term. Justified can be a lot of things, but they just look at the criminal element. And
yes,
I won't go into the whole legal detail because I have for two episodes in a row. The other thing is, and this annoyed me about the Portland Press Herald story about this, he makes some vague reference, the reporter, to no body cam video. That is because Maine police do not wear body cams. Many departments are in the process of implementing them, but very few departments have them. The Maine State Police don't wear them, and not one of these shootings, and they don't want to.
Don't tell me that the technology isn't there.
Well,
give me a fucking break. We already discussed it.
Cops all over the country do, but it's very political. In Maine, the police, particularly Maine State Police, have a lot of power. They don't want anyone telling them how to do their jobs. That's why the criteria for whether a shooting by police is justified or not hasn't changed in all these years, because they wield a lot of power and they don't want to be judged on whether it was necessary, justified by the law, you know, how the law determines it necessary are two different things. And they have learned to say that they basically acted in self-defense.
Yes.
And I just had a couple of points about the Catherine Hegarty episode, our last episode.
Oh, yes.
First of all, Gary Wright, the song.
Dreamweaver.
He was in our Amber Cummings episode last year. He was one of the cops involved in that. That's when I said Dreamweaver. But he ended up being involved in several police-involved shootings and other things. But he also rose in the ranks. He's retired now, but rose in the ranks of the Maine State Police to become one of their top guys before he retired. So obviously there was an incident like 10 years ago where his gun went off. It discharged. It didn't hurt anybody, and he was involved in a Sangerville police-involved shooting, and this shit happens. There was one point I want to clarify. Everybody's probably forgotten. Now, when the cops went to her cabin, Catherine Hegarty, the one cop, the part-time cop, Giroux, thought he was going to talk to her and everything, and I think I made clear in the episode, Wright and the head Somerset County deputy, Hines, had no intention of that happening. But Wright and Hines went in Wright's cruiser and had Giroux drive Hines' cruiser.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, why are those guys going together
yeah.
without him, except for to make their plan for it? And I think I forgot to mention that. And I know it's a point where everybody's like, I don't even remember what she's talking about. That was weeks ago. But just in case you listen to it again, the most interesting thing is Mike Kazmierczyk, I quoted some things he had written, but I accidentally in the editing process cut out the fact that he was writing a book about the Catherine Hegarty shooting. At the time, he lived in Maine. He lives in Texas now. And things happened, and he didn't finish it. But coincidentally, when I contacted him just to say, hey, are you the guy who wrote this book? He was getting back to the book. But he's had access to a lot of court documents and investigative documents and stuff that we haven't. He told me a couple things. I asked him, is it okay if I mention these on the podcast? And he said, yeah, sure. One of them is that in the investigation of the scene, you know, how the camper said she shot like 30, 40 yeah. times at them. They only found 7 shell casings mm-hmm. at the scene. Another thing was that the campers, before they decided to go get help, had this idea. Day, the camper, Robert Day, the one who was very talkative, in his interview with the sheriff's department in their investigation of it, he said that they were, quote-unquote, jamming on their guitars around the illegal fire. So they were making noise. You didn't read anything in the papers or anything, the information we had access to about them jamming on their guitars. So the noise was probably bothering her on top of everything else.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about how we felt that they probably really played down their behavior and everything. Yeah. Before they decided to go get help, when she began shooting, they came up with the idea to, quote, jump her and duct tape her up and bring her into town. We thought we could do her real easy, unquote. And that was Robert Day's interview
what
with
the
sheriff's department. And that just shows, instead of them saying, oh, shit, we're not supposed to be here, we should leave. So they weren't just these nice, polite guys trying to...
No, they're fucking
they were
going to
tie her up and duct tape her. It's like those guys
just because she was yelling at them.
It made me think of the guys in Michigan who were going to kidnap the governor with her. If it was a guy, would they have considered doing that?
Assholes.
I don't think so.
I mean, right. She wasn't shooting at them or they'd right. be dead. They were probably being belligerent.
That just confirms, hearing that from Michael just confirms that the guys weren't the saints that they made themselves out to be. And I'm sure there's a lot to it that they didn't even tell the sheriff because it would just make them look bad. And so should we get to tonight?
Yes. I don't know anything about it. Okay, so I'm good. Excited.
My sources for this story are the Morning Sentinel, the Portland Evening Express, the Portland Press Herald, and the Lewiston Sun, all Maine papers. There wasn't a whole lot written about this when it happened. There's enough, but recently, in the past 10 years, there's been more, but most of it just repeats the same general information, including errors that have been written in over the years. As always, there's nothing better than original sources.
Yes.
I love it when newspapers get their own stuff wrong. Stuff they've reported on, and then they get it wrong instead of just looking in their
archives. And it seems like people don't go far back enough to the source.
No, they...
So the same errors get
Right. I was inspired to do this episode months ago when I watched the most recent Boston Strangler movie on Netflix. They mentioned a possible suspect in some of the early Strangler killings, a Paul Dempsey from Maine. It was a fake name. Mm. But I'm like, ooh, who was that? But I looked it up, and I immediately remembered him from a couple articles in the Morning Sentinel in Waterville when I was city editor in 2015 that we did. And I had thought at the time it was before we did this podcast, but oh, that's an interesting story. And so here we go. The April 25th, 1951, Morning Sentinel in Waterville, Maine, carried a small item at the bottom of a page. It said, Winslow. Charles Terry has returned to the home of his parents, Mr. and Mrs. Frank Terry of Garland Road, after spending the past 2 years in the Marines at Camp Pendleton. That little item wasn't entirely true. The part about him being home in Winslow was, that was true. The part about him being in the Marines was, he had for some of that time, that was true. And he had been at Camp Pendleton in California for some of that time. But it certainly wasn't the whole truth. But the truth would come out soon enough. 3 months and 5 days after the April 1951 little note about Charles Terry being home from the Marines, a different kind of item about him appeared in the Morning Sentinel, as well as Augustus Kennebec Journal and several other newspapers in Maine. The lead of the Sentinel story read, "Augusta, a tall, handsome Winslow man will be arraigned in municipal court here Monday morning on a charge of criminally attacking a 29-year-old married waitress and mother of two children early Sunday morning."
Hmm.
Criminal assault Ooh. Was the legal term back then for rape. And it's funny, the tall, handsome, that's in a lot of every story they use these adjectives. It's
the
crazy.
The way they wrote things is so
I know, it
weird.
Was crazy. Anyway, Terry was arrested quickly after that attack on the 29-year-old woman. And it turns out it followed an attempted attack on another woman a couple hours before. In his version, Charles Terry told police, on Saturday, July 28th, he'd gone to Island Park, a dance pavilion on Cabassie Lake in East Winthrop, just west of Augusta, off Route 202. By his account, he had a few beers and headed home in his pickup truck. But at some point on his way home, he noticed an attractive girl, actually a woman, driving a car and followed her. The woman, Helen Maskowitz, 21, lived in Chelsea. The papers don't note this, but it's the opposite direction of his Winslow home from Augusta, so he would have had to have noticed her pretty quick. My guess is, since he's not a totally reliable narrator, is that he followed her out of the Island Park. In any case, he followed her to her driveway in Chelsea, a drive of probably a good 10 miles or more, which is on the east side of the Kennebec River just south of Augusta. He got out of his car, asked her for directions to Waterville. You're going the wrong way, buddy.
Awesome.
And then he grabbed her. She broke away and ran into her house. He claims he became frightened and left. The story says a few minutes later, but it would actually take longer than a few minutes, he pulled into Pine Corners Lunch on Riverside Drive in Augusta. Riverside Drive is Route 201, and that's the main route. This was before the interstate went up there, and it would have been the main route of how he would have gotten back.
How would he go to Winslow, yeah.
From Augusta. He stopped at Pine Corners Lunch, he says, for a cup of coffee, and ran into an acquaintance, Edward Beckham. Working at the restaurant that night was Frances Hamburger, who owned the restaurant with her husband, Arnold. She was described in newspaper stories as a waitress, but she was actually the owner and apparently working alone that night. If there was a cook or someone else, no story says so. Frances's husband worked nights for Central Maine Power, so my assessment is she ran the restaurant while he was at work or then sleeping during the day. As Charles Terry chatted with Edward Beckham, he showed off his tattoos, which would end up being a mistake. The two men left when Francis closed for the night. Terry drove away, but then came back. By then, the restaurant was closed and locked, and Francis was cleaning up. But my guess is it wasn't very long after she was still in the restaurant part. Charles knocked on the window and told her he'd left his glasses in the restaurant and wanted to come in and get them. She let him in. He looked around for the glasses, but couldn't find them. He bought a pack of gum, and then he grabbed her. The restaurant, it doesn't describe it well in the stories, but I think it was attached to the front of their house, or their living area was in the back. So he grabbed her, she broke away, and she ran back into the living area where she tried to call the police. He grabbed her again and threw her to the floor. Her daughter, who I believe was a toddler, in the next room was woken up by the noise and began to cry. Charles Terry told Francis he'd brained the kid. His words, not mine, if the kid didn't shut up. It's not clear what Frances did to get the baby to quiet down, but she also decided then that it would be a good idea to submit to whatever Terry had in store for her to keep her kids safe. He raped her, beat her up a little, and then he left. Frances followed him outside and tried to write down his license plate number. He saw her doing it and brandished a knife fashioned out of a T-square, one of those metal T-squares, and told her he'd cut her throat, then he took off. When Arnold got home at 5 a.m., he called the police. Francis, according to newspaper articles, was put under a physician's care. Police talked to Edward Beckham, since he'd been talking to Francis's attacker in the restaurant, and it was clear to Francis that the two men knew each other.
Yeah.
The newspaper stories don't say it, but Francis must have known who Edward was for the police to be able to reach him and talk to him. Charles Terry was rousted out of bed at his parents' Winslow home Sunday morning by police, who found him based on, quote, clues provided by the other man who was drinking coffee with him in the restaurant, unquote. according to newspaper stories.
Clues, like what's his name?
Right. Police ascertained it was him by the tattoos he'd shown Edward, which Edward had described to police, so they could be sure it was the same guy.
Yeah.
Charles Terry was taken to the Kennebec County Sheriff's Department in Augusta, where he confessed after questioning, apparently in graphic detail.
Ugh.
He told the deputies, "I get these urges." Charles Pierce, the court recorder, which I guess is a kind of magistrate position in this case, found probable cause to hold him. I think back then they would arrest somebody in the recorder. It wasn't a position like it is now with the people typing in court.
Okay.
It was like he worked for the DA's office or whatever,
okay,
to determine there's probable cause. Because that was done, he immediately determined there was probable cause to hold him. And so Sunday, Charles was put in jail. County Attorney Ralph Ferris, Monday in court, asked for $20,000 bail on each of two counts Charles Terry was charged with. Criminal assault for the attack on Francis Hamburger, attempted criminal assault for the attack on Helen Meskowitz. Ferris said, "In view of the respondent's past record and in view of these apparent irresistible urges he has, we need a high bail."
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Did he confess to the Helen Meskowitz?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. When he confessed, because that's
yeah.
how they knew. Or
yeah.
I didn't know she went to the cops or what. Okay.
No, I don't believe she did. I believe it's not clear, but
okay.
When he told them, he just apparently just told
them.
Well,
you know, they'll
no,
understand.
No,
he got urges.
He had these urges. He couldn't help it. Ferris didn't get his way with the bail. Charles ended up getting $5,000 bail for the attempted rape. Well, this was 1951,
I
remember.
Know.
For the attempted rape charge against Helen Meskowitz, the young woman from Chelsea, and $10,000 for the rape charge against Francis Hamburger. It didn't matter anyway because he couldn't make bond. He was held in the Kennebec County Jail for the grand jury. And remember that notice in the paper 3 months earlier that said Terry was back home after 2 years with the Marines? It turns out he'd been discharged for being quote-unquote undesirable. It's not clear when, but long enough ago that he'd served a prison term in Chillicothe, Ohio for auto larceny. At the time of his return home, he was on parole after being sentenced to 2 years on that charge. It's not clear how much time he actually served, and if I had to guess, though I couldn't find any further information, he probably copped a plea and there were other charges involved, and I wouldn't be surprised if they involved attacking a woman,
yeah,
as you'll see from his behavior. So, who was Charles Terry? Charles Terry was born May 26, 1930 in Waterville, where he lived with his parents, Frank and Shirley, and sister Frances, for the first 10 years of his life in a little house that's no longer there on Pleasant Street. His father worked for Kennebec Canoe Company, a few blocks away, which was owned by Frank's brother. When Charles was five, on June 16, 1935, they were at the family camp on Messalonskee Lake in Sydney, which is just south of Waterville. Charles had an accident. A June 17, 1935 article with the headline "Rescue Waterville Child and Revive Him After 1.5 Hours" in the Lewiston Sun said, "Charles Terry, about 4 years old," actually he was five, "son of Mr. and Mrs. Fred Terry," actually Frank Terry, "of Waterville, was as full of life as ever Monday afternoon after having been unconscious since taken from Messalonskee Lake Sunday night. When the Terry children were called to the piazza of their summer home Sunday night by their mother, the little boy was missing, which prompted the father to go to the wharf where the children had been playing to look for him and saw him lying in 7 feet of water near the wharf. Mr. Terry hurriedly pulled the child from the water and began to use artificial respiration while another person was hurrying for Dr. Arthur McQuillan, whose cottage is nearby. The child showed a slight sign of life once as the father was working over him, but was blue and seemed dead when the doctor arrived. Working more than 1.5 hours on the child, the doctor and father detected signs of life.
Wow.
He was wrapped in a blanket and taken home. The child commenced Monday morning at 3 o'clock to regain consciousness and recognize those about him. Just how long the child was in the water was not known. Mr. Terry is employed by the Kennebec Canoe Company."
Oh.
So back then, I guess you didn't just take somebody to call an ambulance and take somebody to the hospital. You just worked on them for 1.5 hours. And I do wonder if the 1.5 hours is an exaggeration. And
I don't know.
Despite the accident, which I'm sure affected him mentally, the lack of oxygen to the brain, if you just read what's in the paper as Charles grew up, it seems like he had a fairly normal childhood. He first attended Brook Street Grammar School, which was on the corner of Brook and High Streets. Most accounts, from newspapers to Wikipedia, and I'm just saying this because everything says this about the guy, says Brookside. There was no such school in Waterville. And my guess is someone misheard what someone else said, Brookside instead of Brook Street, wrote it down, and it's all been copied as that since. This could have happened in the 2015 article in the Morning Sentinel when I was city editor. This group who was doing a podcast about it came and talked to Amy, the reporter. It's an article Wikipedia and other sources use for information, that article, because it had this timeline and all this stuff with it. I know I get like all caught up in this minutia and these tiny details, but I think that comes from almost 40 years
it's
of working
important.
For newspapers that you want to get facts
well,
right.
Well, there's no reason not to.
That's right. On December 9th, 1938, when Terry would have been 8, the Morning Sentinel ran a full page listing every school Christmas pageant performance in Waterville and every child who performed. Terry, a third grader at Brook Street, appeared in a production of Santa's Red Suit with the rest of his class. He later attended North Grammar School on Pleasant Street in Waterville, right near his house. When he was 10, his family moved across the Kennebec River to Winslow, where he attended Boston Avenue School, then Winslow High School. In March 1946, as a 15-year-old student at Winslow High School, he was part of a group that competed in the state one-act play contest. Winslow's play was In the Suds, and Charles was in charge of sound effects along with classmate Don Whittemore. By the way, I was a member of our school's one-act play contest group, and like many of my high school, it was not a happy experience.
Aww,
we didn't
Mama.
Win. Well, 50 years later, I'm still burning over this. Mm. We didn't win, and afterwards, we got notes from a guy whose name I don't remember, but was a main actor who was on commercials and TV and stuff. He looked right at me and said, people shouldn't try to do accents if they don't have experience doing them. As anyone who listens to this podcast knows, I do have some sort of accent, a vestige of my early childhood in Western New York. I wasn't trying to do a fucking accent in that play. Of course, I was humiliated and didn't say anything, and he didn't single me out, but he looked right at me when he said it, and there were only 5 of us, so it's obvious who he was talking about. I was humiliated, but too insecure to pipe up and say, hey, if you're talking about me, I wasn't doing an accent. That's how I talk, fucking asshole. So I'm saying it now.
He's still alive. He's probably dead. Is he still alive?
I don't know. Oh, I can't remember who he was. I'd have to look him up. Anyway, Charles Terry, in February 1947, his junior year in high school, appeared in the show's apparently wildly successful Razzle Dazzle show. It was a variety show that I can only assume is a ripoff of our high school's Chisel Whizzle.
Yes.
The longest running
Whizzle's been around. It was along for a long time.
It is still around. In fact, it's this weekend if today's big snowstorm didn't cancel.
Oh.
It's the longest running high school production in the United States. And
it is?
This week's is its 133rd annual performance.
Yay, Coney
Didn't
High
Sister,
School.
Weren't you listening when Sister Catherine used to tell us that?
I don't know.
I looked
she
it up
She was
just
a horrible
to make sure.
Woman. She's rotting in hell.
Anyway,
though.
In Rip-Off Razzle Dazzle, Terry was part of a sketch called Uncle Remus Says. And I guess I should mention that Chisel Whizzle and apparently Razzle Dazzle 2 had racist minstrel show stuff. I'm sure Uncle Remus Says was one of them.
Yeah.
That they used blackface and thankfully was gone by the 1970s when we were involved. Also that spring, Charles was part of the Kennebec County 4-H Club competition, where he and buddy George Toll presented on how to select a herd sire. But they were beaten out by Don Whittemore and Eldwin Wixon Jr., who presented on how to classify Jersey cattle. A winning pair went on to the state competition in Bangor. And all of this minutia is just to show that whatever Terry's issues may have been, on paper at least, he seemed to be getting through life like a 1940s teenage boy. After his junior year in high school, he dropped out of school, or was asked to leave, as you'll see, and joined the Army National Guard. In November 1947, when he was 17, Charles won tickets to 3 University of Maine football games for helping to recruit 26 young men to the Maine Army National Guard as part of a nationwide recruiting competition. Terry's commander, Staff Sergeant Bernard Began, won the big prize, two tickets to the annual Holy Cross Boston College football game, donated by Holy Cross alum Robert Mayhew, as well as train fare and a night's stay in Boston.
Ooh.
And I only mention that because I went to Holy Cross, so I think it's funny. Such a big deal. On April 29th, 1948, which would have been my birthday if I'd been born then, and shortly before Charles Terry's 18th birthday, he was listed as a private and among the members of the 3rd Battalion, 103rd Infantry, who took part in an inspection by the heads of the U.S. Army National Guard. In June 1948, after he turned 18, Charles Terry enlisted in the U.S. Marines, and in August, a short story in the Sentinel said that four local men who'd enlisted in the Marines, including Terry, were on their way to Parris Island, South Carolina, to attend boot camp. A story in September noted that the four were back on leave after boot camp, and that Terry would then report to the Naval Gun Factory in Washington, D.C. for duty. The next item, 4 months later, says he spent the previous 4 months in Washington, D.C. and was home on a 19-day furlough before reporting to duty at Treasure Island, San Francisco. And the item after that is the one I mentioned at the beginning, the one in April 1951, that he was home with his parents after 2 years with the U.S. Marines, where he'd served at Camp Pendleton in California. No mention that a lot of that, as I said, we don't know how much was actually spent in an Ohio prison for auto larceny, and that the Marines had dishonorably discharged him. In my experience, those notices in the paper come directly from the military, but I'm not sure how it was done in 1951, and if the info could have possibly come from his parents. It seems unlikely to me that the military would supply that information given his discharge and prison sentence. But who knows? The military is not famous for the right hand knowing what the left hand is doing. And if it was just an automatic thing, okay, this guy's, he enlisted this time, so he's out, and blah, blah, blah. Who knows? As I said earlier, I tell you all that about Terry's early life, not to be boring as shit. He was just a normal guy, high school, military. A feature story in the Morning Sentinel in October 2015 paints a different picture. It's funny but not surprising that a good deal of this is repeated on Charles Terry's Wikipedia page's fact when it's actually the recollections of men who were in their 80s at the time this article was written. I'm not saying that they were wrong, but just that recollections colored by information learned in the ensuing years and over 50 years old can be funny things. The feature has the headline, "Remembering a Convicted Killer, Mainers Who Knew Terry Say Connection to Boston's Strangler Killings, quote, sounds like him," unquote. Full disclosure, as I said, I was city editor of the Sentinel at the time, and unless I had a day off, likely played some part in editing the story. I remember the one a week before, an article that I mentioned earlier by Amy Calder, who interviewed podcasters about a series they were doing on Terry. I don't remember this one with as much clarity, but that's not to say I wasn't involved. In any case, these friends remember Terry as an odd boy who was mean to people, stole, incited teachers to anger, was frequently suspended, and then got kicked out of school. Quote, "He was a very antisocial type individual," unquote. Lowell Hawes, 84 at the time of the article, recalled. The defining moment in Terry's high school career, apparently, because two of these guys brought it up, is vivid in the memories of Hawes and Lee Hapworth, Winslow High students at the time. Hawes recalled, and I'm quoting him here, "He's sitting in biology class all stretched out, and he's tearing up a piece of paper and dropping the pieces on the floor. Pearly Hanscom, the biology teacher, said, 'Charles, will you pick up the paper?' Charlie ignored him, just like he wasn't there," unquote. And this is Maureen breaking in. Pearly is an old-time male name in Maine. I just want
people to make
sure this teacher is a man. Pearly Hanscom, the teacher, is described in the article as a barrel-chested, well-respected teacher and former boxer, unquote.
Ooh.
But remember, too, that Terry was a big guy, well over 6 feet and not skinny. But back to Lowell Hawes' story, I quote, "After the third time, the teacher picked him up and threw him against the wall. Charlie turned white and ran out the door." Lee Hapworth, 86 at the time of the article, also recalled the incident, but a little differently. Hapworth said he was a sophomore when this happened. In Hapworth's version, the teacher, Pearly Hanscom, sorry, all these names sound like Hapworth, Hanscom, you know, it was, tells Terry to go to the office. Hapworth says, "He didn't go. Charles Terry was tall. He was big. So Pearly Hanscom came over and he opened the classroom doors. I knew something was going to happen quick. Pearly started writing something on the board. He turned around and said, 'Charles, you haven't gone yet.' The next thing we knew, he threw him, chair and all, right out the door. Hepworth added, "That's the way it was back then. Yeah. Teachers were in control." Yeah, I say, yeah, I think Pearlie.
But even when I was in school, I saw a teacher throw somebody against the wall once.
I did too. Pearlie would have made a good nun. That's all I
know. Oh, yeah. The nuns.
Hepworth said he got kicked out. He didn't come back after that. Hepworth said that Terry was smart. He wasn't a dumbbell, but had been suspended before. Those times, his parents had made a big effort to get him back in school. This time, apparently, Hepworth said it was for good. And I'm not saying this incident didn't happen, but I also wonder if those guys were both really present for it. They're two years apart in age, and when this article was written in October 2015, if Terry was alive, he would have been 85. So one of these guys was 84, one was 86.
Yeah, they were like
Terry would
between.
Have been 80. So right in between the ages of the other two. We know he was still in high school the spring of 1947 when he turned 17, his junior year. So if Hepworth was a sophomore and was in the classroom, then Terry was too, and that means Terry would have been a sophomore and still been a student for another year. Hawes would have been a freshman and not have been there to see it. Maybe it was their junior year, and that's when Terry left and joined the National Guard. It would have been spring since he was in the Razzle Dazzle shows earlier that semester. I know I sound nitpicky, but I'm just pointing out how memories cannot always be accurate.
Yes.
The two stories differ. I do wonder, I'm not saying teachers didn't pick up kids and throw them, but Charles Terry, by the time he was fully grown, was 6'5" and over 200 pounds.
Ooh.
And I do wonder if maybe the teacher grabbed him and pulled him out of the room or something. In some ways, it doesn't matter, but it just shows all that is, it's not fact, you know what
yeah.
I'm saying?
It's someone's recollection. Or right. Like you said, you know how things become
stories
lore.
Over
yeah,
the
you
years.
Know.
And hey, remember that time Pearlie
yeah.
Hanscom picked up Charlie
yes,
Terry?
Exactly.
Yeah. The men in this article also tell stories about Terry being a chronic thief and doing things like throwing rocks at one of them when they were in their early teens down at the lake and other things. You wonder what he may have done with girls that was never reported. In any case, it all came to a head in August 1951, long after those high school days, when he was arrested and charged with the attempted rape of Helen Muscovich and the rape of Francis Hamburger. After that arrest in Brunswick, 50 miles to the south of Winslow, a straight shot down Route 201, police were ecstatic at Terry's arrest. They'd been trying since May 29th that year, 1951, to solve the murder of Shirley Coolin, and Charles Terry seemed like somebody who could have done it. On Sunday, July 29th, police from Brunswick, as well as Maine State Police, questioned Terry about the Coolin murder. Police from Bath, just east of Brunswick, also wanted to talk to him. They'd had a troubling spate of women and girls being attacked as they walked through the city at night. Maybe Terry was their guy, too. The Kennebec Journal noted that State Trooper Guy Batchelor of Waterville was, quote, assigned to the unsolved scarf strangulation slaying of pretty Shirley Coolin in Brunswick. Actually, Batchelor was not assigned to the case. He was assigned after they talked to Terry to check his alibi, and more about that in a minute. But right now, let's take a tangent and talk about what happened to Shirley Coolin.
Okay.
Shirley, 24, was a part-time waitress at the Bowdoin Hotel in Brunswick. She was a single mother. All the articles say she was three times married, though only two of the marriages were ever discussed in any of the articles. She lived with her mother and father, Sarah and Chester Murray, in Brunswick. Her daughter, Doreen Ethelyn, 5, also lived with her. On the night of Saturday, May 26, 1951, Shirley went to a movie with a friend. Afterwards, she went to have a drink with a friend who was also a waitress at the Bowdoin Hotel in downtown Brunswick, and that's where they had their drinks that night. At around 10:45, Shirley left, saying she had an appointment to keep. Her body was found nearly 3 days later at 8:30 p.m. on Tuesday, just down the street in the flower garden of the Park Row home of Mrs. W.B. Center by Mrs. Center's maid, Lillian Chase of Bodenham. Mrs. Center and her adult daughter and adult son had just returned from a visit to the cemetery where they were decorating graves for the upcoming Memorial Day. Lillian Chase, the housekeeper, on her way home for the night, stopped in the garden to check on the early flowers, and that's when she saw the body, though she at first thought it was a drunk who had passed out. She told Alfred Center, Mrs. Center's son, who was also the state representative in the main house for that area. The article in the Lewiston Sun on Wednesday, May 30th, the day after Shirley's body was found, led, The body of an attractive, thrice married divorcee, a red scarf knotted tightly around her neck, was discovered Tuesday night in a flower garden behind a Park Row home, about a quarter of a mile from the Bowdoin College campus. And as we mentioned earlier, adjectives were a dime a dozen in 1951, newspaper writing, and Shirley will be described in almost every story, no matter what paper, as attractive, pretty, or comely. I've noticed in my research for this story, of all women, whether they're killed or accused of murder or anything else, if it's a crime-related story, they are described as pretty or attractive. And Charles Terry is frequently described as handsome, though also described as tall or husky. It's like they have to use these adjectives. I don't know. Immediate reports after the body was found quoted Brunswick Police Chief Joel LaBelle as declaring, "It looks like criminal assault and murder." And a reminder, criminal assault was legal term for rape back then. And just a quick description of downtown Brunswick before we continue. The main drag is Main Street, spelled like the state with an E on the end. It's less than a mile long, and at the south end is Bowdoin College. Main Street then sweeps down a hill with a beautiful green space, the town mall, in the middle for the first quarter mile. On the east side of the mall is Park Row, a narrow street that runs parallel to Main, separated by the mall. Along Park Row are the stately 1800s-era homes of what was once the town's wealthiest people. The houses are still there, but now they're mostly commercial offices and apartments. The Centers had started a department store chain in Brunswick that was once a prominent chain of department stores in the state, and they were a prominent family, probably one of the most prominent in Brunswick at the time. A fun fact, the yard where Shirley's body was found is a side yard, and the house next to it is now a hotel and a restaurant called 165, where I attended a Holy Cross Maine alumni event last summer. I wish I'd known as I gazed at the pretty yard that right outside that window, there was once a body in part of a big murder case, but I didn't. Anyway, Lillian Chase, the housekeeper, as reported, found Shirley's body face up behind a cedar hedge in a flower garden in the side yard of the center home. The home on the other side where I attended that event last summer belonged to Morgan Cushing, a professor at Bowdoin. There was a red scarf tied around Shirley's neck. Some of the newspapers called this the scarf murder or the red scarf murder.
Oh, yes.
And a 3-inch bruise and other cuts and contusions on her face. Her clothing was disheveled, her skirt pushed up. The scarf was hers, one she'd been wearing, along with a blue skirt and matching jacket. And some articles say pink blouse and some say white blouse. It rained. She was killed on Saturday night, found on Tuesday night. There had been a torrential downpour Sunday night, and she was wearing this red silk scarf, and I'm wondering if the scarf bled onto her blouse, so some of the reporters at the scene thought it was a pink blouse when it was really a white one. Not that it matters. Nearby, the police found a 6-inch celluloid letter opener with a plastic magnifier at one end. They picked it up for evidence, but weren't sure if it had anything to do with Shirley being killed. And you know, celluloid is kind of plastic that's not very heavy or thick, and it would not make a great weapon, though I think somebody could threaten somebody with it, but I don't think it would be very easy to stab somebody with it. Shirley's handbag was also nearby, soaking wet. The last rainstorm was Sunday night, a real soaker. Police Chief Joel LaBelle told reporters that they were going on the assumption Shirley was killed either Saturday night or early Sunday morning before the rain. The spot where her body was found was described by the Portland Press Herald as the darkest, most secluded part of the garden and the only spot not visible from the street. I happened to be driving by Brunswick the other day, and so I stopped off and got some photos, which I'll put on our website, because the house and yard and everything really haven't changed that much since then. The fire department came over and lit the yard with spotlights to help the investigation as local officials waited for state and county ones to show up. Throngs of people, residents and college students gathered at the scene. Many stayed through the night as the scene investigation began. Shirley's body was later taken to a local funeral home and then on to Portland for an autopsy. There was no shortage of potential suspects from the start. Shirley was a waitress at a popular in-town restaurant, where co-workers said she was friendly, a good worker, well-liked, and reliable. She was well-known to patrons and, being a lifelong Brunswick resident, also was well-known around town. Her mother, with whom Shirley and her daughter lived, did laundry for Bowdoin students and rented parking spaces in their driveway to them, so they were friendly with many of the young men who attended Bowdoin. The Murray's house at 27 South Street no longer exists. There's a Bowdoin dormitory there now. But at the time of the murder, South Street ran along the southern end of the Bowdoin campus, a grove of Brunswick's iconic white pines, separating the homes from what was then the college president's house, a stately white mansion, and now it's used for administrative offices. At the time, Bowdoin was an all-male college. Shirley had befriended many students, and while the newspapers tried to make a lot of hay about it, Shirley's mother said that Shirley was more of a big sister to them than anything else. And she wasn't that much older. She was only 24. Police initially said that when Shirley left the Bowdoin Hotel at 10:45, it was to meet a boyfriend. But to hear what her friend who was with her actually said later, this was another of those police assumptions about women and their relationships with men. And we'll get some more of this and this. Shirley never said she was meeting a boyfriend, according to her friend. Since Shirley had already been married three times, or maybe two, in her young life, suspicion turned to her former husbands, well, actually just to one of them. One husband, George Dowdswell, had been a British sailor, apparently stationed either at the shipyard in Bath or at the Brunswick Naval Air Base during the war, it's not clear which, and Shirley would have been a teenager when they were married. I don't know how these things work, but that marriage had been annulled, even though her next husband, Guy Coolin, said that Shirley's daughter was the British sailor's, not his. Those are the only two marriages ever specified in the papers that I read. They keep saying she's thrice married, but nobody ever mentions what the third one was, when it was, who it was, if he was in the picture, if, or anything. The marriage that was most interesting to investigators was her two-year marriage to Guy Coolin, who was 31 in 1951 and living in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Guy was a native of the Bath and Brunswick area and had married Shirley in 1945, either when he got back from the war or before he was shipped overseas, even though the war was ending, depending on which article you read. He said he married her to, quote, give her child a name, unquote. That's what he told police. They got divorced in 1947. According to Guy, it was she who instigated the divorce. Even though Guy lived in Massachusetts, he had been in Brunswick over the weekend. Remember, it was the weekend before Memorial Day, and he had visited with his mother, who also lived in Massachusetts. I think he lived with his parents, with his mother and stepfather in Massachusetts. Guy worked at the Boston Naval Shipyard. He'd formerly been a mechanic in Bath, not at the shipyard, though, but at an auto garage. Guy and his mother spent the weekend before Memorial Day with family in the area. They were in town to visit graves in honor of Memorial Day. Back then, Memorial Day wasn't on a Monday, and it wasn't a long weekend. It was actually the following Thursday that year, but people worked during the week, you know, so they came up for the weekend and did their Memorial Day stuff. Guy's visit would have been more innocent sounding if he hadn't told police that Shirley, who apparently didn't know he was coming up with his mother, had written him a letter asking him to meet her Saturday night on Park Row. He told police he didn't go, though, and his family could vouch for him. Coolin told police he'd happily come back to talk. He was back in Dorchester by now. And Maine State Police hit the road Tuesday night to pick him up in Dorchester, which is a neighborhood of Boston. Once he got back to Brunswick, police got more details out of Guy. He didn't meet Shirley, he said, because his mother kept him from going to see her. And you really get the impression that Guy's mom did not like Shirley at all. Guy said he'd gotten two letters from Shirley recently, which he'd ignored because he thought she wanted to get back together, and he didn't want to. They've been divorced by now about 3.5 years. Anyway, he said he was in love with someone else, a 14-year-old neighbor in Dorchester, who he planned to marry when she turned 15. And remember, he was 31 at the time.
Gross.
This development piqued the interest of Boston police, who wanted him to come back so they could slap him with a morals charge. They didn't waste any time once they saw that news in the Wednesday papers. He was scheduled to appear in court on that charge Thursday, even though it was Memorial Day. So that was less than 2 days after Shirley's body was found. But Guy told Brunswick and Maine State Police he'd stick around as long as they needed him Wednesday to help them with their investigation. Police also said they had evidence that even though Guy said the marriage had few squabbles, he'd beaten Shirley on several occasions. Guy Coolin was the best, but not the only suspect in the days after Shirley's body was found. The day after her body was found on Wednesday, police were looking for two Bowdoin students who'd been expelled the week before. Bowdoin College, founded in 1794, is the closest thing Maine has to an Ivy League school. Yeah, I'm looking at you, Colby. Huh.
What about Bates?
And Bates. It gave us Hawthorne. It gave us Longfellow. It gave us Joshua Chamberlain, a Civil War hero. It gave us Freeland Stanley, who invented the Stanley Steamer, and Robert Perry, the Arctic Explorer. It gave us sex researcher Alfred Kinsey and Richard Hornberger, who wrote the book MASH. It gave us numerous prominent journalists, ambassadors, and judges, including two Supreme Court justices. It gave us U.S. Senators Bill Cohen and George Mitchell. It also gave us two dipshits who got expelled after they broke into a biology laboratory, stole alcohol, the kind used for experiments, flavored it, called it punch, and sold it to fellow students. One was rumored to have been more than friendly with Shirley. Police told reporters he was going out with Shirley, but Shirley's mother said they were just friends and it was one of those big sister situations. Shirley never took him seriously, Sarah Murray, her mother, told a reporter. We've talked before in many episodes about how male policemen get this wrong all the time. My guess is that the kid hung around where Shirley worked, making goo-goo eyes at her and asking her out, and she humored him. The two students, who were apparently living in Portland at the Y, 25 miles south after their expulsion, were questioned Wednesday night by Police Chief Joel LaBelle in Portland and slated for more questioning in Brunswick on Thursday morning. The two said they'd be there, but then they didn't show up. Late Thursday morning, Brunswick police got a call from U.S. Marine Staff Sergeant William Hart, who worked in the Marine Recruiting Office in Portland. He said the pair had showed up there that morning and told him they'd been expelled from Bowdoin and they wanted to enlist in the Marines. Hart gave the pair some forms to fill out then, having read that morning's paper and knowing that police had questioned two Bowdoin students who'd been expelled, and it said in the paper they were going to continue questioning them Thursday morning, called the Maine State Police. A Maine State Police trooper showed up at the recruiting office, picked up the boys, and brought them to.
It's interesting how on top of things people were back then.
Well,
Like, I
everybody
can't.
read the paper,
Yeah,
unlike
they
now.
did.
There weren't as many information sources, so everybody was reading the
I
paper.
know.
The two geniuses said it was all a big misunderstanding. They thought someone from Brunswick was going to come down and pick them up because the car they had was so crappy. Like the
Sure.
guy would have known that. When no one showed up, they went to join the Marines. Chief LaBelle emphasized to reporters that the two were being questioned only as people who knew Shirley, not as suspects.
They
Right.
would say that.
One thing I find interesting is that the police released the names of a lot of the women they talked to on the case, Shirley's friends, her fellow waitresses, and such, but none of the names of the men they talked to were released, except, of course, Guy Coulin. And those women took a lot of shit from a lot of people in town, it turns out. My guess is that because all the men were considered suspects, and even though the police said they weren't, that was trying to find out information stuff was just bullshit. Anyway, the two Bowdoin students told police that they were on Vinyl Haven, an island about 60 miles from Brunswick, the night of the murder. After they were expelled, a buddy with a private plane and a place on Vinyl Haven, remember, this is Bowdoin, so everybody's rich, flew them out there. They came back Wednesday, the day after Shirley's body was found, and borrowed a car and headed to Portland and got rooms at the Y, where they were later that day picked up by police after police were told that one of them was friendly with Shirley and someone apparently told police where they were staying in Portland. By the time, late Thursday, after they were questioned in Brunswick, the two Bowdoin dipshits were brought back to the Portland Y and told not to go anywhere just yet. Guy Coulin, Shirley's ex-husband, was being held at Charles Street Jail in Boston on $10,000 bond, charged with rape of his 14-year-old neighbor after his court appearance earlier Thursday. The Lewiston Evening Journal reported that Judge William Lynch in Dorchester District Court cleared the courtroom of spectators before Guy Coulin, red-eyed and hair-rumpled after hours of questioning, according to the paper. And it's not clear if it was the questioning of late into the night before in Brunswick about Shirley, or if it was the questioning about his affair with his 14-year-old neighbor. He faced the girl and her mother in court, according to the paper. The case was continued until June 8th. The same story reported that Muriel Koulavatos, a waitress at the Bowdoin Hotel, had sat with Shirley at a table Saturday evening, and Shirley kept asking what time it was. Muriel went upstairs to change her clothes around 10:45, and when she came back down, Shirley was gone. The Bath newspaper reported that Muriel told police that Shirley had told her she was going to go meet Guy, but before that, she was going to go meet a Bowdoin College student that she was dating. It's not clear where this came from because Muriel is adamant later in both reports and talking to reporters that Shirley didn't say who she was going to meet or characterize the relationship in any way. She didn't say boyfriend. She didn't say guy. She didn't even say it was a male that she was going to go meet. Deputy Cumberland County Sheriff Harold Whittemore told reporters that they were still looking for a missing earring at the scene, which Shirley may have lost during the quote-unquote death struggle. Meanwhile, Mrs. Center, it turns out her first name was Emma, though that's rarely used. She's usually referred to as Mrs. W.B. Center in the stories, told police that she sleeps in a first-floor bedroom about 200 feet from where the body was found, is a light sleeper, but heard nothing. Lillian Chase, the housekeeper, also elaborated to the newspapers about finding the body. She said she stepped through an arbor that leads to the flower garden to see why it looked like all the flowers there were wilting and saw Shirley's body. She ran back into the house and alerted her quote-unquote employer, Alfred Center, Emma's son. So I guess Emma wasn't her employer. Alfred was, since he's... As I said earlier, they just returned home from decorating graves for Memorial Day. The paper also reported that Shirley's quote-unquote flimsy red silk scarf was tied so tightly around her neck that it broke a bone and pierced her windpipe.
Ah.
At this point, I'm like, are the police telling the press every single detail and every single piece of evidence in the case? I think they were. By Friday, the autopsy results were out. Dr. Wilbert Layton, Cumberland County Medical Examiner, and Dr. Franklin F. Ferguson, assistant pathologist at Maine General Hospital in Portland, said Shirley had been strangled to death. Superficial cuts were found over her right eye and on her chin. They said she had not been criminally assaulted, aka raped. I'm not sure how they'd know that for sure, since as we discussed with the Sophie Sergi murder, only 20% of rapes leave any evidence of physical violence or physical contact.
Yeah.
And if the guy doesn't ejaculate in her, no semen would have been left. Shirley's mother didn't report her missing when she didn't come home Saturday night because she said she knew Shirley had plans to meet Guy and assumed she'd gone off with him, maybe down to Boston. Police told reporters they were satisfied with Guy Coolin's account of his whereabouts on Saturday night, that he was with family and didn't go meet Shirley like she'd asked him to. The uncle they were staying with said he would have woken up if Guy had left the house. There was no more elaboration on Guy's alibi, but it doesn't really sound like a solid alibi to me. Family members
no,
are not.
No, me neither.
Shirley and Guy had had a stillborn baby boy before the divorce, and Guy said Shirley brought divorce action shortly after that. Police were also looking into a report that Shirley and a man were seen arguing on the Brunswick Mall Saturday night. The mall, as I said, is a wide swath of grass with a gazebo and trees and stuff that separates Main Street from Park Row. Another woman told police she thought she heard a scream shortly after 11, but there was nothing they could do with either report since the people reporting them didn't have any other information. Brunswick Police Chief Joel LaBelle said now they were working on the possibility that one of, quote, Shirley's men friends could have been the slayer, unquote. Police said they believe Shirley put up a terrific struggle with her killer, but they don't say why they think that. It had been previously reported that the ground around where her body was found didn't look that disturbed. It just looked like the body had been dragged under the hedge. Her skirt was pulled up, but her clothes weren't torn or otherwise disheveled, and there weren't any defensive injuries. The injuries to her face, there were some, but they were minor. Mm-hmm. She hadn't been battered or anything. Guy said that Shirley, who was 5'6" and about 150 pounds, was incredibly strong. By Friday, nearly a week after Shirley was killed, the two Bowdoin students had been cleared after a third student confirmed they were on Vinyl Haven. Now they were in the clutches of the U.S. Marines, which had taken their application seriously and signed them up. Hello, Korean War. Police and the newspapers had a new focus anyway. The letter Shirley had written to Guy asking to meet, which police said and newspapers reported was Shirley asking Guy for a date. The Lewiston Sun even called it a tryst. I'm going to read the letter. It's not very long, and you can determine for yourself. Dear Guy, I've written to you once and asked about my phonograph, and since you didn't answer, this will be the last time. I'm sending this one special delivery in case your mother put the last one in the stove. I know you are not married, and if you're not tied and chained to anybody, I want you to come down this weekend. And even though Maine is... northeast of Boston, people use the term
yes,
You're working days, so you should be able to be down here Saturday night by 10:30. I'll go to the last show at the pastime. I'll look for you when I come out. You park a little way on Park Row. We can find each other easier that way. I'm working days. If I shouldn't be there, go up to the house, but I'm pretty sure I won't be working. Will you please write and tell me if you're coming? If so, tell me if you think it's warm enough to go swimming Sunday. I guess it's not quite. Maybe you can help with the baby's grave this year. I haven't gotten a full shift yet. Don't show this to anybody. Love, Shirley. And the papers made a big deal, I'm not sure why, of the fact she said, don't show this to anybody. My feeling is that his mother did not like the relationship, yes, and she just assumed people didn't know she was meeting up with him. But it doesn't sound to me like she's asking him for a date.
Well, it kind of does, but...
I mean, there's a string of non-sequiturs. I kind of wonder, too. She wants him to help with the baby's grave. Maybe she wants to get back together, but... You're not going to have a date standing in the dark on Park Row at 11 o'clock on a Saturday night.
Yeah, she doesn't really say why she wants to meet him.
Right.
Like, does she want to talk to him about
something?
Well,
she wants her phonograph, obviously. Yeah. But I don't characterize that. They made it sound like she wanted to get together with him stuff. I don't characterize that.
No.
Since Guy never answered the letter, Shirley had no way of knowing he was driving up with his mother. The station master at the Brunswick train station right next to the hotel said a woman matching Shirley's description came in a little while before 11 asking if the train was going to be on time. She likely would have assumed that Guy was taking the train, and from the letter it sounds like they were in contact, at least occasionally, that she knew what his work schedule was. What it doesn't sound like to me is someone asking somebody on a date. And to set the scene, the hotel where Shirley worked and was having drinks that night is right next to the train station. It's now the Brunswick Hotel. They're right across Main Street from the south end of the mall, and it's less than a minute walk across to Park Row. So it makes sense that Shirley would ask Guy to meet there. It's quiet and they could talk. They could have met on the mall, but people probably would have seen him. The Bowdoin campus was not even a quarter mile from where Shirley's body was found up Park Row. And then at the other side of the campus is where her house was. Yes. I walked it the other day and it took me maybe 10 minutes to walk. It's all very compact, this whole thing. By this point, police said they checked with Guy's relatives, and as I said, he was alibied. They said they could account for all but 5 minutes of his time that weekend. So he was in the clear. Coolin said he and his mother had arrived in Bath from Boston around midnight Friday and went to bed around 3 a.m. On Saturday around noon, they went to Booth Bay Harbor to put flowers on his grandmother's grave. And Bath is east of Brunswick, like right now, at 10-20 minute drive. They returned to Bath around dinner time and spent the rest of the night at home. Sunday morning, he and his mother left Bath and stopped in Brunswick at the home of Shirley's sister, Ethelyn Littlefield. He asked Ethelyn where his son's grave was, and she told him Yarmouth, which is a town, it's like halfway between Brunswick and Portland. He first said he and his mother stopped at the grave in Yarmouth to lay a wreath on their way back to Boston. This is according to the first story that mentions this. Later stories say that he gave the wreath to Ethelyn to bring to the grave, though he did ask her where the grave was. No reporters that I can see ever asked Ethelyn which one was true, whether he just stopped by to find out where the grave was.
It would make more sense that he gave it to her, though. Unless he was going to take the train, get off the train, go.
No,
to
they
the...
drove. He and his mother drove.
Oh, he and his mother drove. Sorry.
I think it was his mother's car. That's why Shirley assumed he was taking the train, because he made it clear he didn't want to see Shirley or talk to Shirley, which is why he wouldn't have asked Shirley about the baby's grave. I think this is important, and I'll bring it up later, so put a pin in it.
Okay.
Shirley's funeral was held Friday, June 1st in Yarmouth, where she was buried next to the grave of her baby son. All bearers were her mother and four Bowdoin students who either parked their car at the Murray South Street home or had their laundry done by Sarah Murray. That same day, a Portland Press Herald headline crowed, "Slayer's Trail Fades." But Philip Wheeler, the state investigator, told reporters that day the investigation is just beginning to roll and that they were going to break the case soon. Investigators decided it was time to zero in on all of Shirley's male friends. Unfortunately for them, this whole thing was fraught with a lot of issues, mostly police not being able to sort the bullshit from the real information. They were getting a lot of rumors. A lot of people were passing on, it appears, speculation and rumors, but passing it on as fact. giving them names that never panned out, all sorts of other things. And I suspect the police were not able to get out of the way of their own assumptions about Shirley and her relationships. The investigators were beginning to feel overwhelmed with all the conflicting information people were giving them. But they had a great solution. They were really excited about it, as a matter of fact. Dr. Arthur Drew of Providence, Rhode Island, had arrived in town with a new contraption he'd developed. He called it a lie detector. Brunswick police had already used it once with great success in the murder earlier that year of Lancelot Cooper. They used the lie detector to charge his wife Evelyn with his murder. Her trial was due to start later that year. Dr. Drew set up his lie detector in the Water District building in Brunswick and went to work. In short order, they were able to clear some local sex offenders, some airmen from Brunswick Naval Air Station, and the adult son of a prominent family that lived on Park Row and was said to be an admirer of Shirley's, who disappeared the day she was murdered and only showed up back in town a week later. It turns out he was fishing up north and totally clueless about the whole thing. According to the Lewiston Sun, a steady stream of male friends and acquaintances submitted to the lie detector over the weekend of June 2nd and 3rd. The story said that the lie detector was only used on people who volunteered, and officials revealed that it couldn't be used as court evidence in Maine. The story explained that the lie detector measures a person's blood pressure, respiration, and perspiration. Quote, if a person submitting to quizzing with the apparatus lies, the operator knows from one or all of the indicators that a lie has been uttered. By the beginning of the following week, investigators were anxious to re-interview Guy Coolin using the lie detector because apparently some information his mother gave them didn't jibe with what he told them. What the details of this were is one of the few things that investigators didn't share with the press. They'd been so open with all the other information, but whatever this information was, they didn't share. But Guy was cooling his heels in the Charles Street Jail in Boston on those pesky rape charges. With the help of Massachusetts State Police, Dr. Drew, who by now was back in Rhode Island, administered the lie detector to Guy at Massachusetts State Police headquarters in Boston. State investigator Philip Wheeler and Cumberland County Assistant County Attorney Arthur Chapman made the trip south for the lie detector test. Dr. Drew said afterwards, Guy Coolin was given a lie detector examination on the Keeler lie detector, and in my opinion, there was no specific evidence of his lying or having any connection with his former wife's death, unquote. The next day, investigators said Coolin was cleared, but said there were still a lot of other angles to pursue. While they were in the Boston area, Wheeler and Chapman dropped some evidence off to be tested by the Harvard University Bureau of Legal Medicine. They also were still investigating whether Shirley's murder was related to a bunch of attacks and attempted rapes of women by a masked man in Bath who had yet to be caught. Investigators were certain that whoever killed Shirley lived in the Bath-Brunswick area. Another intriguing clue was released by police that June after they visited the Harvard lab. Three irises have been placed on Shirley's body, they thought, something that today we might call the signature of a killer or a serial killer. Police were baffled. It indicates a sex fiend to me, one investigator told a reporter, but wouldn't elaborate on why. I don't think he knew. Remember, this was 1951, and police and the public knew a lot less about the eccentricities of killers than we do now. I question, though, the significance of those iris leaves. I'd have to see what they were talking about. With the torrential rain, how could they still be there? None of the initial descriptions said her shirt was pulled up or anything. So they maybe were on her clothing. On the other hand, with the torrential rain, if they'd been on the ground, if a gardener had been trimming the irises, they could have like somehow gotten stuck to her clothes. Yeah. It's just not clear what they were, and we've seen plenty of cases where police misinterpreted something as significant that turned out not to be. They didn't give the iris leaves any significance, any thought at first, and only thought they were significant after they talked to the Harvard guys a couple weeks after she was killed. It just seems to me, I question whether it was anything. And that'll come up later, and there's a reason I'm so cynical about it. But in subsequent weeks, they cleared a bunch more guys, including a local clam digger who lived on Pleasant Street and was harassing a young female neighbor, as well as another sex fiend. They also cleared a private from the Brunswick Naval Air Station who showed his appreciation to a young woman who gave him a ride home from Lewiston by attacking her near the gate to the base. She fought back hard enough that her windshield was broken in the melee, as well as her nose and a couple fingers. She somehow talked the guy, Nathan Gagnon, into letting her drive to the guardhouse where she reported him. He said she was the one who attacked him.
Yeah.
He had some scratches on his face. They made them both take lie detectors.
Oh, they love that new machine, didn't they?
And she won. And I don't know where the lie detectors came from. Lie detectors for that thing, not for...
Okay. Surely. Yeah, I know. I know that. But I'm just saying they're just making everyone take lie detector tests.
Well, and what other crime... And what other crime is the victim required to take a lie detector? But
no shit.
Nathan Gagnon was also questioned about Shirley's murder. He was not given a lie detector for that one, and he was cleared. Every once in a while, as the days, then weeks went on, the newspapers would report investigators said they had a big break in the case, only to report the next day, never mind, it wasn't one after all. So you can imagine that when Charles Terry, remember him, was arrested for attacking two women in the Augusta area on July 25th, 2 months after Shirley was killed, how excited the investigators were. They didn't wait for Terry to come to them. The day he was arrested, Brunswick Police Chief Joel LaBelle, Cumberland County Deputy Sheriff Vernon Bornheimer, and investigator Philip Wheeler all made the 45-minute trip up Route 201 to talk to Terry at the Kennebec County Jail. Terry was questioned for 3 hours, after which Maine State Trooper Guy Batchelor was assigned to check his story. Batchelor was scheduled to report his findings to investigators in Brunswick at noon the next day. Wheeler said Terry was very cooperative and even volunteered to submit to a lie detector. Of course, the lie detector was back in Providence, a 5-hour drive away, with Dr. Drew. It wasn't needed anyway. A story a couple days later with the headline, Terry is cleared of any tie with Coolin murder, led, because he remembered his every move on his birthday anniversary, a Winslow man who admitted assaulting a waitress was today cleared of any suspicion in the strangulation slaying of another waitress, Shirley Coolin, 24, Brunswick. The story went on to say that Coolin was killed May 27th, Terry's birthday. He remembered what he did, and it all checked out. The one thing the story got wrong is his birthday is actually May 26th, and I assume that the cops got the date right, and that's the day she was killed. So apparently he related to the cops everything he had done that day, which he could remember because it was his birthday, and then Guy Batchelor, the state trooper, checked his alibi, and it all checked out. They said the lie detector wouldn't be needed after all. He was free to go.
Oh.
While newspapers said Terry was cleared, Philip Wheeler, the lead investigator, said they simply couldn't tie him to the murder, but they wouldn't rule him out. There was just no evidence. I could do a whole episode on Shirley Coolin. I practically have at this point. I know.
Yeah.
But right now, I'll just say that her murder was never solved. I like Guy for it. Family members give shitty alibis. For instance, his uncle, with whom they were staying, saying he would have woken up if Guy had left the house, unless the uncle was sleeping directly on top of Guy, on top of his body. I don't count that as an alibi.
No, I don't either.
And the whole baby wreath thing, it seems like it was a last-minute deal, and I wonder if it was somehow to give Guy some kind of credibility, something to make Guy look good to the cops. It seemed to me from Shirley's letter that in 4 years he'd never done anything for the kid's grave, and he admitted he didn't even know where the grave was. So why all of the sudden, particularly when, if she'd been alive, her body hadn't been found yet, he wouldn't have known she was dead, right? There was a chance of running into her either at her sister's house or the cemetery. Why would he leave a wreath when he didn't want to see her at all? That's just one little thing to me that calls his story into question. By the way, the rape charges against him were dropped when he married the 14-year-old. Yeah. With her parents' consent a few months later.
Ugh,
so,
kid.
Back to Charles Terry. While Charles Terry was in jail that summer waiting for his trial, another woman thought he might be the guy who assaulted her on Lisbon Road in Lewiston. She said a man ran her car off the road and then assaulted her and raped her. But when she was taken to have a look at Terry, she couldn't identify him. I wonder if they had her take a look at Nathan Gagnon, the guy from the airbase. The day she was assaulted was the day before he assaulted the young woman who gave him a ride home from Lewiston. And Lisbon Road is Route 196, the route you'd drive from Lewiston to Brunswick. So many men, so little time to look into their assaults.
Every time, though, like with Shirley's murder, there's always so many people it could be.
I know.
Credibly,
I
you know?
I know. Charles Terry was indicted in September 1951, pleading innocent. I guess back then they didn't plead not guilty, they pled innocent, to both the rape and attempted rape. Remember those? On October 10th, he took a plea deal, pleading guilty to rape if they dropped the attempted rape charge. Terry, who is described as tall and handsome, as well as curly-headed in the article about his plea deal, was sentenced to 8 years. D.A. Ralph Ferris asked for a harsher sentence because Terry had attacked a mother in her own home with her kids nearby. Judge Ronald Weber told Terry that because of his plea deal, he'd taken years off of his sentence, saving the victims and witnesses the ordeal of testifying. Now, that's all well and good, but I bet Ann Stevens, a 46-year-old Waterville woman, wished he'd gotten more time. In the early morning hours of Sunday, February 8th, 1959, a homeowner in Fayette, Maine, a town west of Augusta, was surprised to see a woman stagger out of his garage. She was badly injured and covered in blood. The homeowner called the sheriff's department. Ann Stevens told a harrowing tale. The night before in Waterville, she'd met a man at a bar near closing time. He took her to an Augusta restaurant for a late dinner and then drove her to a lonely road in Fayette, where he stopped the car, took off his glasses, and grabbed her by the throat. She said she passed out and came to later on the road, her clothes and hair matted with blood. She staggered to a nearby garage where she crawled into a snowplow truck to spend the night. The temperature was below zero. The next morning, she made her way to the home where they called for help. Kennebec County Sheriff John D. Winter testified a few days later that Ann was taken to Augusta General Hospital, where she was treated for a broken jaw and multiple bruises and contusions. On June 26, 1959, Terry was sentenced to 1.5 to 3 years in prison for the attack, which I think is a pretty shitty sentence given his history. He obviously didn't do the full 8 years because he was sentenced in October of 1951. He did less than 7 years. He got out in February 1958. The shitty sentence, I think partially there was some victim blaming. Anne was unemployed, and what was she doing picking up a guy in a bar, etc.? There wasn't a ton of coverage, and it's not even clear if anyone at the Sentinel or Kennebec Journal remembered him from the attacks of 8 years before, when they did a lot more coverage. As I said, he hadn't served the full 8 years. On November 1st, 1958, a few months before the attack on Anne, he married Therese La Rochelle of Vassalboro. She ended up divorcing him after his Anne Stevens conviction and taking back her maiden name, which is good, because when she was married to him, she was Terry Terry. Therese. Stories years later say Terry and his wife got back together after he got out of prison, and I feel like there's almost a little judginess in the way those stories are written. But I offer you this. In 1962, that's the year he was out of prison and would have gotten back together with Teresa, a North Vassalboro family, and that's the town Teresa lived in, made a complaint to police saying Charles Terry was putting their daughter in danger. Police couldn't substantiate it or find anything to charge him with. I'm going to make a good guess that that was Therese La Rochelle.
Yeah.
Charles Terry, meanwhile, worked at the Old Crescent Hotel in Waterville after he got out of prison the second time. He got fired in June 1962 for not being able to take orders, a later police report said. He also, in 1962, worked for a time at the Wyandotte Worsted Mill in Waterville. He'd been visiting Boston on the weekends, and at some point he left Waterville altogether. By summer of 1963, he was in New York City. In June 1963, Zenobia Clegg, 62, was strangled with her own scarf in her apartment at the Woodstock Hotel on West 43rd Street in New York City. Her naked body was found by a maid. A considerable sum of money had been taken, according to police, but her expensive jewelry was left alone. She was apparently posed after she was killed. It's not clear how. And a pear, the fruit, next to her right leg was somehow indicative of having been purposely placed there by the killer. Zenobia was born in Romania and lived most of her life in Worcester, Massachusetts. She wore the scarf to cover scars from cancer treatment and arrived in New York City 3 weeks before after a world cruise and a stop in San Francisco. She'd been widowed 8 years before, then divorced from her second husband, Nayland T. Clegg, a hotel chain auditor. She was staying in the Woodstock Hotel in Greenwich Village, where she told staff, according to a UPI story, that she had terminal cancer and was going to whoop it up and drink a lot of whiskey before she died.
It's a good way to
do it. Blame her. The night she died, she ordered a bottle of scotch be sent up to her room. Police rounded up 9 people who'd seen her with a man shortly before she was killed. Their descriptions were fed into an electronic image maker, which came up with a composite of the man. Police found matchbooks in her apartment from Greenwich Village restaurants and cafes, so armed with the composite, they started asking around at those places, and that led to the arrest of Charles Terry, by now 33, who was living in the village and working as a furniture mover. When he was arrested, he had a gold cigarette case inscribed with Sonovia's name and $700 in traveler's checks belonging to her. Here's an account of what happened to Zenobia Clegg, according to Terry, and taken from a court appeal document. Keep in mind what we've learned about police statements and court documents, what's left in and what's left out, and also that this is Terry's account. In the early morning hours of May 30th, 1963, Terry strangled to death Mrs. Zenobia Clegg in her room at the Hotel Woodstock, located in Midtown Manhattan. Mrs. Clegg was a chance acquaintance, whom Terry had met for the first time on the street at the corner of 6th Avenue and 43rd Street on May 29th at about 10 p.m. She was small and old. She limped and used a cane. She approached Terry and asked that he show her the way to her hotel. I read somewhere else, this is the court thing, but I read somewhere else, actually she was getting a cab and he offered to help her to her hotel. In any case,
sense.
He agreed. En route, they stopped at various places for drinks. At about 1:30 a.m. on May 30th, they left the bar in the lobby of the Hotel Woodstock, took the elevator, rode to the 11th floor, and entered Mrs. Clegg's room. In her room, they had some more drinks. While they were sitting on the bed, Mrs. Clegg asked Terry if he would like to have some sex with her. He agreed, but he was unable physically to perform as a man is expected to in such a situation. I'm reading again from the court.
Okay, yes.
In Terry's words, this is what happened. And then this is a quote from Terry. She started calling me a little boy and saying, "What's the matter? Can't you get a bleep?" And I'm going to assume that's hard on.
Or
"Are you
boner.
Still a little child?" Yeah, or that's what I'd say, boner. "Are you still a little child or something? What's the matter? What does it take? A bleep to give you a bleep." May, I'm guessing she was going to say a blowjob to give you
someone
a
to give you a blow. Yes.
"I blew my top, slugged her a few times, choked her with my arm." Terry told the police that he pressed his forearm on her throat and held it there for 5 minutes until she stopped breathing. Specifically, when asked by a police officer, "Well, when you say she stopped breathing, what do you mean? Do you mean she was dead?" Terry replied, "Yes, yeah, she was dead." Terry thereupon passed out. Upon regaining consciousness, he helped himself to various items of the deceased's personal property, walked down the 11th flight stairway, and departed from the Hotel Woodstock as dawn was breaking. 3 days later, on June 2nd, a chambermaid found the deceased lying on her bed and not breathing. Hotel employees, the police, and a medical examiner were summoned. The medical examiner pronounced her dead, and on the following day, June 3rd, following an autopsy, he determined that she had been dead for a period of 2 to 5 days, but the cause of death was strangulation. On June 5th, at about 11:30 p.m., Terry was picked up at a Greenwich Village bar by a police officer who, accompanied by several other police officers, took him to the station house. There eventually emerged a confession by Terry, first given orally to Detective Locurto and later reduced to a written, unsigned statement given to Assistant District Attorney Fogarty and recorded by a stenographer on a stenotype machine. Terry later, there were issues with the statement he gave. I'm not saying he didn't do this.
Yeah.
The signed statement is always a problem. The police fudged the amount of time because there are rules to how much time you could. That was part of his appeal. And I've seen this. I just read a book, The Trials of Walter Ograd, where it was in Philadelphia and they were only allowed to question someone for 6 hours. So the police lied about, they faked the log where he signed in because they actually questioned him for 14. So anyway, but that is what happened. That basically how Charles Terry was arrested. The big news, as far as AP and UPI were concerned, were that Detective John Donovan of the Boston Police Department traveled to New York to talk to Terry in relation to 6 strangulation murders of middle-aged and older women in Boston because Terry was from New England. These were the first 6 of the 13 Boston Strangler murders, which happened from 1962 to January 1964. All of the first 6 murders were quote-unquote elderly women, and all were strangled with their own clothes, just like Zenobia. Maine State Police Lieutenant Miller Nickerson told Waldo Prey of the Portland Evening Express that Terry was the most likely Boston Strangler suspect since the killings began. Detective Donovan of Boston, who had come down to talk to Terry about the Boston Strangler murders, because a lot of Zenobia's stuff sounded like Boston Strangler. She was middle-aged. Same. She had been strangled with her own item, posed. Detective Donovan of Boston told reporters that he questioned 5,000 people in the Boston Strangler case, and at one time or another, 1,000 could have been classified as suspects. In any case, Terry wouldn't talk to Donovan, so Donovan finally went back to Boston. Charles Terry never said anything about the Strangler murders to anybody. But he told police, when he confessed to the Zenobia Clegg murder, quote-unquote, that he was responsible for murders in Oakland, Maine, and Brunswick, Maine. Since Shirley Coolin hadn't been solved yet, and spoiler, it's not really a spoiler, but it was never solved, she was the Brunswick one, they figured. They couldn't find one in Oakland that matched, but found one in neighboring Fairfield, Patricia Wing, who was beaten to death in 1958. While few stories mention this, Patricia Wing actually lived in Oakland. She was killed right over the town line in Fairfield.
Oh. So,
my theory on why he copped to these is because at the time New York had the death penalty and he was hoping that he could trade information for a plea deal or something. Or at least make police think he had info, right, and get sent back to Maine, which does not have a death penalty. Unfortunately, that only works if the police who have you for the murder in their state want you to go to another state. If they want to kill you in New York, they're going to kill you in New York. I don't think he killed Shirley Coolin anyway. The likelihood of him being on Park Row when she was there to meet Guy at 11 p.m., 50 miles south of where he lived, doesn't make sense to me. No one saw him talking to her at the hotel. Part of his M.O. apparently was he would follow people from the bar or whatever. But nobody saw him or mentioned seeing him around town. And he was a distinctive guy, 6'5 and more than 200 pounds. I'm not saying it's impossible he'd be in Brunswick. Route 201 goes straight from Brunswick up to Winslow. But I think Guy is just a much more likely suspect. Guy's alibi, as I said, was sleeping family members, including a mother who hated Shirley. He knew Shirley would be on Park Row. Charles Terry was viciously violent, and his assaults left a lot more evidence and certainly more violence on his victims than what was left on Shirley. Shirley's wounds on her face were more just like to control her. Charles Terry viciously beat people even when he strangled them. Also, if you look through the annals of Maine's solved and unsolved murders of women, Shirley's doesn't stand out as any more of a signature killing than many others. There are plenty of strangulation murders of women. Many women are strangled with their own clothes. And this doesn't mean the guy wasn't intending to. Guys who are practiced at this know she's going to be wearing a bra, she's going to be wearing a scarf, she's going to be wearing a sweater, she's going to be wearing something like
this. Yeah, I can use.
It happens all the time. The fact that a pair was found placed next to Zenobia's right thigh and 3 lily leaves were supposedly left on Shirley's abdomen is kind of a stretch as far as similar signatures go.
Yeah.
Zenobia was posed in an obvious enough way that it was described that as the time. Shirley, stuff later, like nowadays, says she was posed, but no one said it at the time. She was lying face up and someone had dragged her to the spot, kind of under the hedge to keep her from being seen. Zenobia and the first 6 strangler victims were posed in a way, like I said, it was obvious. It's not like a guess that they were posed. I do believe it's more likely Charles Terry killed Patricia Wing, the woman in Oakland. Yes, her body was found in Fairfield, but she lived in Oakland. And Charles Terry would have been in neighboring Winslow. It's all in the Waterville area.
Yeah.
At the time she was killed, Fairfield wasn't mentioned that much. She was described as an Oakland woman. It was in all the papers. She was killed in June 1958, and Terry got out of prison in February 1958. So even if he didn't kill her, he would have been aware. Yeah. It was a big story because she was the mother of 5 kids. Everett Savage, an Augusta businessman Patricia was having an affair with, was convicted of assault and battery, but not murder in her death. It's a really complicated case, and I don't want to get into all the details until my next episode.
Ooh.
When I will do it, other people have done it, but I will do it in my style. Everett Savage's complicity was always questionable, and you'll see why. Terry may not have done either. You may read in places that he confessed to murders in Brunswick and Oakland, Maine, but like I said, he didn't confess. He just somehow indicated that he would talk about them. I don't think he said much because the New York cops didn't give a shit. They notified Maine cops, but the Maine cops didn't pursue it. Everett Savage had already been convicted.
Yeah, they don't care.
And they'd already cleared Charles Terry, or not really cleared, but they'd already looked at Charles Terry for Shirley Coolin and didn't have anything. Back now to Charles Terry and Zenobia Clegg. Terry was found guilty of murder on October 9th, 1963 by an all-male jury after an 11-day trial. Interesting side note, since it was a capital case, meaning he could get the death penalty, it was a policy in New York that they didn't put women on the jury for capital cases because they thought it would be too distressing for them. At least that's what they said. My guess is they thought women would be too soft on the guys and wouldn't be as willing to fry somebody. Under a new New York state law, the jury then had to deliberate on whether, after they found him guilty, on whether he would get the death penalty or life in prison. A month later, on November 9th, the jury unanimously agreed that Charles Terry should get the electric chair after deliberating for 6 hours and listening to 2 days of testimony. It came out during the two-day hearing that psychiatrists, including in Maine, had determined that Terry was a psychopath and sexual deviant who enjoyed sadistic sexual acts. One said, Terry appears to be an aggressive, emotionally conflicted, unstable, and immature individual with unresolved sexual conflicts. Right. He discusses his involvement in a detached manner without apparent guilt feelings or expressions of remorse. He admits inability to control rage reactions to real or imagined affronts, particularly while under the influence of intoxicants, unquote. The testimony went into psychological reasons from his attorney on why he shouldn't get death. But the Associated Press story, I read that and just said they went into psychological reasons. It didn't explain what they were. A judge still had to make it formal, and that happened December 5th, 1963. Charles Terry was sent to Sing Sing to await his fate. You may read in articles that Terry's death sentence was commuted, but this isn't really what happened. New York at the time was struggling over the death penalty. Its last execution was in 1963, and in 1965, Governor Nelson Rockefeller signed legislation that the only time it could be used going forward from 1965 was when someone killed a police officer. But that made all the guys on death row prior to 1965, it's like, how are you going to kill them when you're not going to kill everybody who comes after? Yeah. So they kind of stopped doing it. Then, as we know from our Gary Gilmore episode, the death penalty was declared unconstitutional in the U.S. in 1972. That only lasted until 1977, but New York had had enough. It went back and forth on it, beginning in 2004. So, given the appeal process and everything, that appeal document I read was Terry's final appeal in 1972. He was appealing on the grounds that his confession, there were issues with his confession. Terry died in prison in 1981 of lung cancer at the age of 51. But what about the Boston Strangler stuff, you may ask?
Yeah.
Well, just like the JFK assassination and UFOs and everything else, we'll never really know the truth. Terry never talked to the Boston cop, and as we know, Albert DeSalvo confessed, quote-unquote, all 13 Boston Strangler-related murders, which happened between 1962 and 1964, though his confession was to fellow inmate George Nassar, who easily could have been the strangler himself. Both were clients of F. Lee Bailey.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, DeSalvo's DNA connected him to Mary Sullivan, the final strangler victim. And you'll see a lot of stuff that says that confirms he was the Boston Strangler. DeSalvo's attorney, the notorious F. Lee Bailey, and John Donovan, the Boston cop on the Strangler case, both say they were sure DeSalvo was responsible for all of them. But many experts on it, and I mean law enforcement, not like internet speculators, believe the murders were actually committed by more than one person, either copycats or linked by the cops because they were similar. The six first Strangler victims were strangled with their own clothes, just like Zenobia Clegg and Shirley Coolin, for that matter. But that's not uncommon, as I said. It's a convenient way to strangle a woman. A lot is made of the fact that many of the Boston victims were nurses or worked at hospitals or had been treated at hospitals, and Zenobia Clegg had had cancer, hospital connection.
Yeah.
But I don't think this is a big deal. Boston has a shit ton of hospitals.
Yeah.
Back then, if you were going to be a working woman, nurse was one of the most likely careers. Even now, it's one of the top careers for women. So I don't see it as relevant, and it doesn't make it any more relatable to Charles Terry either. I mean, in Maine, his known victims were waitresses. So was Shirley, and the Waterville woman he attacked and left for dead in Fayette was unemployed. Thomas Cavanaugh, who arrested Charles Terry in New York for Zenobia Clegg's murder and was the one who elicited that confession, thought Terry was responsible for at least four of the first six Boston Strangler murders. In a 1993 interview, Cavanaugh, as I said, who got Terry to confess to Zenobia Clegg's murder, said that he was sure Terry did some of the Strangler murders, but Boston cops didn't want to admit that a New York cop had solved their case. Cavanaugh said that the Boston cops just weren't interested, although I'll point out Donovan did try to talk to Charles Terry, and Charles Terry refused to talk, and what more are you going to do? Cavanaugh and a bunch of retired detectives who called themselves the Over the Hill Gang got together in the early 90s after DeSalvo's guilt came into question. It's a whole long story involving George Nassar and shit that I'm not going to go into, and if you're hoping after listening to me for all this time that you were going to hear a big, long Boston Strangler thing, it ain't going to happen. You can look it up. But Barbara Walsh, who lives in Winthrop, Maine, and at the time worked for the Tampa Sun Sentinel in Florida, where Cavanaugh lived, did a lengthy feature on why he thinks Terry was the Boston Strangler. Cavanaugh pointed out that the first six victims were older women who were determined not to have been raped, though we'll never really know, and were molested with an object after death. They were posed in quote-unquote grotesque positions. The younger victims, the later victims, were all raped, and few were posed. Dr. John Spencer, a Florida psychiatrist and an expert on sex crimes, told Barbara Walsh that there is no way Zenobia Clegg was Terry's first murder. Spencer said, first of all, that if it's your first murder, you're going to take off, not stick around and decorate the body. He looked at the crime scene photos, and I've never seen a good explanation of the pear. I don't know if it was slices of pear or an actual pear, and it was placed next to her thigh. I don't know if it was in between.
Yeah, I know, like what?
But Spencer did confirm that the body looked posed and that the pear was placed. Tom Cavanaugh, the cop, told Barbara Walsh, "I lived with this case for 29 years. I thought of it from time to time and wondered how we could have gotten Boston to follow up on Terry." Cavanaugh died in 1996, and his son Brian, who had been an assistant state attorney in charge of homicide in Florida, took up the cause. In 2015, he was part of a documentary crew from Northern Light Productions of Boston making a podcast about Terry and his involvement, and they visited the Morning Sentinel newsroom in Waterville to talk to reporter Amy Calder about it, and I was city editor at the time and edited that story. Back to Tom Cavanaugh, he wanted Boston to pay attention. None of the Charles Terry stuff involving the Boston Strangler or the Maine stuff was ever followed up on. I think Cavanaugh, as a cop, knew that other cops aren't going to follow up when they have who they think is their guy, or at least someone who can be their guy, even if they secretly might harbor doubts.
Yeah.
I've seen some mention of why no one followed up on Terry's quote-unquote confession about Oakland and Brunswick murders in Maine, but as I said, it wasn't a confession. He just indicated, vaguely, apparently, some involvement. In Oakland, somebody had already been convicted, even if it wasn't of the murder itself, and more next on my next episode. In Brunswick, as I said, they were just not, after all those years, going to follow up. Terry was in prison, sentenced to death. Years had gone by. Despite some people characterizing what he said as a confession, it doesn't sound like it was one. It was something vague, and like you said, and like I said, he was probably either hoping to get sent up to Maine to be tried for one or two of those, or at least to be questioned, or to trade information for not getting the death penalty, or something else. I believe Terry was likely involved in the early Boston Strangler murders, and it just goes to show that if a guy shows you that every single time he's out of prison, he's going to rape and attack women, you need to pay a little attention. I'm sure that there are many more he's responsible for that we'll never know about. That is my story.
Thank you.
I didn't know
anything about him.
It's kind of become one of those things. I think that some other podcasts have done it.
The Shirley,
yeah,
it sounded familiar, but it also sounds, so I don't know.
Do you have an NNW?
I do. Okay, first of all, I need to follow up on my NNW about True right. Detective.
The Jodie Foster.
I finished it. I can't remember what score I gave it.
8.
Yeah, it devolved into
the Boston Globe's TV critic thought the ending was rushed, and I can't remember what he said about it, but yeah, he really thought the ending and solution was not good, and that there were loose ends that weren't tied up.
One of the things that bothered me, and I'm not a scientist, but the storyline was a science storyline. A bunch of people, like I said, they were from this lab or disappeared, and you find pretty quickly on that they've all been killed except one person. And they finally find the guy, and he tells them whatever. I don't want to give any spoilers, but his explanation for why a certain thing happened was very simplistic and dumb, and it bothered me because I just thought this is way too simple. But also it got, and I don't know, I didn't see the other, from what I've read, because after I watched it, I read a couple things online. So some of the other seasons kind of have a, I don't know the word, not supernatural, but a kind of otherworldly undertone.
Right. Which and I don't so really this like.
Did too.
Yeah, I don't like that.
A lot of times it was hard for me to figure out what the fuck was going on. And I feel like this has happened in other HBO shows where it just seems really, I'm not using this as a metaphorical way, it seems dark, like I can't see what's
right,
going
I agree.
On the screen. Maybe well, I'm losing my sight like mom and I need shots in my eyes.
Wasn't it supposed to be like the time in Alaska when the sun doesn't come
yes,
up?
Yes, but even when they're inside, when yes, I know it is, I don't know. I just, it was okay. I mean, I didn't expect
oh,
it to
I'm
be
not
great.
Gonna...
I didn't watch the other seasons of it because it didn't look like the type of thing I'd like. And
no, it doesn't pass back.
Like I said, I watched because of Jodie Foster. Yeah. But anyways, whatever. If you like Jodie okay. Foster, you might want to watch
and
it.
So now you have another NNW.
Yes, I do.
All
yeah,
right.
I do. Is it, you have a problem with that?
No.
Okay, so this one, it's not a, well, it's kind of crime.
If it you doesn't think have Vietnam, to be. We can do whatever we want. It's our thing.
I was going
to
say, if you think the Vietnam War was a crime, then it has ooh. Some crime relation. So on Audible, I get a credit a month. I couldn't figure out what to listen to. And I'm like, you know, I'd like to listen to just some fiction. And I've listened to Kristen Hanna before, who writes, I don't like the term chick lit, but she writes usually present day, just, you know, fiction about women's relationship, shit like that. I think she wrote one, Firefly Lane, about these two women that grew up together and stuff. I saw some of the series on Netflix and it sucked. But anyways, she's kind of hackish, but I'm like, oh, maybe I'll listen to that. It's long. I usually go by the length, and I don't like it when they're too short because I feel like I'm wasting my money if it's not long.
I'm the same way.
There's this one called The Women, which is new of hers, and it takes place during the Vietnam War era. So I'm like, oh, this might be okay. The woman's a nurse in Vietnam. Let me just give you a brief synopsis. It's about this woman. She's young. She's like 20. She turns 21 right after she gets to Vietnam. It's 1967 when she goes. She's a nurse in the Army. She had been a nurse. She went to nursing school, but she didn't have enough practical experience. She tried to join the Navy to be a nurse, and they wouldn't take her, and neither would the Air Force, because they want someone with 2 years practical experience, but the Army didn't care. Mm-hmm. They would take anyone that wanted to join up. So that's how she ended up in Vietnam. So let me go through the NNW things, and then I'll talk about it some more at the end. Bad reenactments, now that doesn't apply. Narrative cliches, taking a point off, because Kristen Hanna, it's always narrative cliches. It's just everything's a cliche in this book. The woman she grows up privileged, and I can't even think now, but just take it from me. There's a lot of cliches. Any cliche you can think of. Her brother dies in Vietnam, and that's, oh, first she joined, before he dies, she joins up because she wants to see if she can find him or whatever. I don't know. And then he dies after she joins up. You know, she falls in love with some guy. He gets killed, supposedly. Mm. Maybe, maybe not. Blah, blah, blah. Anyway, racial gender obtuseness, taking a point off. When she first gets to Vietnam, she's got two roommates or tent mates, whatever. One is a Southern woman, white woman, and the other is a Black woman.
Of course.
I think she's from Oakland or something. And the Black woman, brother is a Black Panther. Remember, this is 1967, is very into the civil rights movement and all that. That's fine. But, and this book takes place from 67 to 82, 1982. Granted, it's not through the point of view of the Black woman character. So it's through the point of view of this woman.
Yeah, you know, these things, but, how the Black people, they're never from like Erie, Pennsylvania.
No.
Or something like that, you know?
I know. So the thing is, the Black, there never seems to be any issue with her being Black. No one's ever giving her shit for it. I'm not saying people should. I'm just saying,
but realistically, but so it's a poorly drawn character in that she's kind of this cliche.
She's just a regular friend. She's like her best friend her whole life. Wonderful, but there's no problem. I mean, there's only like a couple things. Oh, you're a rich white girl. What do you know? But there's nothing.
But nobody treats her differently because she's Black. See, to me, that's not realistic.
I know that it's a slippery slope. You don't want to get a lot of shit as a white writer for writing about a Black woman's experience when you're a white woman.
Put it this way. If you're going to put a Black person in your book, you need to do some work to understand
how their
lives are different than your white life and how people treat you differently. And there's plenty of information out there that you can find out. You know, it is a slippery slope. Do you have a book with only white people and not appropriate anything? If you're gonna put a Black person in your book, you can't just say, okay, here's a Black person who's just like a white person, except for she's Black, and she has these cliche brother who's a Black Panther, and she's into civil rights and stuff. And she says, what do you know? You're rich and white.
But
other than that, there's nothing.
There's nothing. A lack of good visuals doesn't matter. Missing pieces, not really. I couldn't tell. Too many other things were annoying me about it. I still kept listening to it. But inaccuracy and anachronism taken off 2 points.
Wow.
Because, as I said, 67 to 1982. Now, I don't remember everything from, obviously, I was only two in 1967, but I do remember things from the, you know, early 70s. The people in this book are constantly using phrases that were not around. I'm going to rock your world. No one said, I'm going to rock your world in 1967.
No.
No one said, called someone girlfriend.
No.
Just all this shit. And it's like, look, you're trying to write a story. And I'll talk about this at the end, about the actual story itself or about the subject matter. I'm not talking about the subject matter at all. I'm talking about, there are constant phrases and there are also attitudes that were not apparent. Now, I know that when people got back from Vietnam, there were some people that called them baby killers and stuff like that. But in the late 60s, there were very few. There might have been, you know, like people who were war protesters. But I remember people coming back and people being happy that they were back. Maybe they didn't get any parades and stuff, but there were people that were like in this book, her parents, who are conservative white people from Coronado Island in California. Her father was very angry and they were ashamed that she was in Vietnam.
See, that's bullshit.
Didn't tell anybody. They told people that she was studying in Florence.
No, that's
Give
bullshit.
Give me a break.
People were very rah-rah, pro-America, pro-soldier, pro-military. And
70s.
I'm old enough to remember it.
Yes.
And if you were against the war and against soldiers and stuff, it was offensive to people. And I want to point out about the parades, because that's a big cliche. The parades for the other wars came after the wars ended and we had won them.
We won them.
There were no parades for guys coming back from Vietnam because A, the war wasn't over, and B, when we finally got our sad asses out of there, we hadn't won it. And that's why, and it, like, oh, I never got a parade. Well, the World War II guys who got parades got them after VE Day and VJ Day, you know.
And also, talk to fucking poor people that served in Korea.
Yeah,
they didn't even get a fucking monument.
I know.
I mean, they were totally, yeah. But anyway, so that was a bunch of bullshit and it bugged the shit out of me. I'll talk about the fact that it was about women in Vietnam, not men. Her attitude of her parents, I can see maybe her parents were not happy that she went, but I can't see her father, who was very rah-rah military, being ashamed that his daughter was there. And not telling people, especially after she got back, not saying, yes, she served, you know, whatever. I just think it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I think
I am so not going to read that book.
You wouldn't anyway. You probably never read Christian Hand. I know people, this whole baby killer and people spitting on people in the airport. I know it did happen to some people. I'm not dismissing people's bad experiences. I'm just saying it wasn't commonplace, especially in the late 60s, even though there were people who were against it and there were starting to get people were starting to question what the U.S. was doing there.
Didn't you text me that like four people said it to her in one day or something?
Yeah. Like, give me a break.
Yeah.
So no. So I took 2 points off. Storytelling, I don't know. It was okay. It was like soap opera-y. So I'm not taking points off. Freshness, I'm taking half a point off for the cliche thing. So repetition, no. Beating the drum, I'm taking a point off because it's funny because in her, the acknowledgments, and I think she's in her 60s, that author, and she says, oh, I wanted to write this story for years, but I didn't feel like I had the, you know, writing experience or the, you know, whatever. And I'm like, you still don't. The story is an important story to tell about women in all wars.
You need to know what China Beach.
Yes, although I got to talk about that in a minute. The beating the drum thing comes in because several, I don't know how many times someone said there weren't any women in Vietnam. And she says in her acknowledgement, she talked to a lot of nurses from Vietnam that were served in Vietnam.
So people say to her there weren't any women in Vietnam?
People said to the character.
Oh, okay.
People said to the character, when the character said, I served in Vietnam, the character was trying to get help because she had PTSD. Although they didn't know what it was at the time. So she went to the Veterans Administration and stuff trying to get help. And they said, well, the women didn't, this is for combat veterans. You're not a combat veteran. I understand all that. And I understand that nurses, especially nurses in war, saw a lot of horrible things. And they do have PTSD. And that it's an important story to tell and could have been told pretty well, but it wasn't. So I gave it a 4.5. I wouldn't listen to it. I would like to watch China Beach, but it's not on streaming because of the music rights. When I was looking up to see if it was on streaming, I found an article from 1988 when it first came out by somebody who had served as a nurse and thought a lot of it was bullshit, but she said a lot of it was really good, but the stuff that was bullshit was even worse because the rest of it was so good or something like that. And then apparently at the same time, which I forgot because I never watched, was one called Call of Duty, a show that took place in Vietnam. And she said that was totally unrealistic and stupid. But yeah, China Beach isn't streaming anywhere because of the music rights. It made me think of that. And then it also made me think of MASH. Because that depicted nurses during wartime.
Right.
It was a Korean War. But anyways, yeah, I wouldn't really recommend this book. Maybe if you like Kristen Hannah, but her other books are easier because to me, they're more contemporary. I think if you're trying to do historical or something that's a period, like I wrote about it on Threads and people agreed with me, most people.
I agree too. You have to
get things right.
You have
to. I'm watching a TV show, that's why The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I couldn't keep watching
it. I couldn't, even if you don't know what people were saying in 1972 or whatever, you don't have to use stuff that people are saying now. Just
you
don't
can watch
have
TV from phrases. Back then too. It's right. not like it's 1872 when there's no way to know how people spoke. You can watch movies and you can see what people, how people's voice inflection's different and stuff like that. The one that bugs me, and she said it in this book, someone said someone was stalking somebody. I remember it was early 90s when that became a thing, because I remember specifically I was working in the law office and there was a guy that was constantly calling my boss with stupid complaints about one of his family members. I had written a phone message from this guy saying, and I remember the guy's name too, saying somebody was stalking him. And we all thought that was so funny because it was just new to the lexicon.
Right. And you may not remember our long forgotten episode of years ago about Chrissy Grimmie and Teresa Saldana and Rebecca Shea. I think I talk about the origins of the term stalking in relation to that kind of behavior.
It wasn't a thing in the 70s. No. You didn't say someone was stalking you.
If you did,
you could say someone was following me. Somebody won't leave me alone.
If you did, you didn't say it because it was a term, but you were thinking of like a predator stalking its prey.
Yes.
And we're using it in those terms. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a normal term for that.
That was my, but yes, China Beach, I would like to see it to see if it held up. But you know what? Because I was looking for that for some reason earlier today, I started watching, which is the same era, Northern Exposure, and watched the first episode of that. A lot of it hasn't really held up, but
I didn't like it when it was on, so I don't think I'd like it.
It was
now.
Okay. It was too.
I just felt it was too cutesy. It was overly quirky.
Yeah,
it had it. But so we should probably get going. Thank you. Probably wouldn't have read that book anyway, as you pointed out, but now I definitely will.
Thank you for doing the episode, and I will probably.
And we'll be back in 2 weeks. God damn it. My thing messed up, so I can't.
That's what she said.
I know.
That doesn't make sense.
From on October.
Ow! Sorry. Ow.